Yeah, that's true.
People actually really congratulate, that's a great lesson, wow, you learned a lot.
That's great.
All right, I'd like to introduce our speaker today. The Sunstone session is called, give us the title, they didn't give it to me.
Oh, really?
Yes. What's that?
Judaic Primitivism, a new model of Mormon origins.
Okay, so we're glad to have everybody here. Don Bradley is a former writer and editor and an MA student in history at Utah State University. His research focuses on earliest Mormonism, particularly the life of Joseph Smith and the emergence of Latter-day Scripture. He's presented 5 times at the Salt Lake City Sunstone Symposium, 2 times at the Mormon History Association Conference, and 1 time at the Restoration Studies Symposium. His piece, The Grand Fundamental Principles of Mormonism, Joseph Smith's Unfinished Reformation, appeared in the April 2006 issue of Sunstone. So Don, please go ahead.
Thank you. I was unfortunately unable to print this paper, so I will be using my digital Urim and Thummim here. Crucial to our understanding of the origin and character of Mormonism are the intellectual sources that we posit for it and the patterns on which we believe it was built. Many such sources and patterns have been offered by scholars over the past several decades. In this paper, I'll review the most significant of these. These explanations, I hope to show, are singly insufficient, and so I will argue, is the interesting model Jan Shipps has offered to integrate them. A review of the various explanations in her model will serve as a springboard for me to craft a new model, one that I believe provides greater explanatory power and directions for further research. 19th century commentators on Mormonism usually found glib explanations for Mormon origins, with the rare exception of someone like Emerson, for whom Mormonism was an afterclap of Puritanism. They largely explained Mormonism as just a fraud or a delusion. Such conceptually poor categorizations continued into early 20th century scholarship, much of which traced Mormonism's roots to the founders' reputed epilepsy, hypnotic ability, or alleged pilfering of the Book of Mormon manuscript. It's only in the wake of World War II that historians started to take Mormonism seriously as a religious movement and find its theology worthy of explaining. In the immediate wake of the war, Whitney Cross, a student of Perry Miller and Arthur Schlesinger Sr., pioneers of intellectual and social history, respectively, applied both approaches in his book, The Burned Over District. Cross attempted to literally locate Mormonism's roots, explaining it by the characteristics of the region in which it emerged. Mormonism, on his analysis, grew from upstate New York's Burned Over District, the ground of which had been enriched by successive blazes of revivalism. It was rooted in the region's, quote, heritage of moral intensity and blossoming in the heat of evangelistic fervor. 3 years later, Cross's masterwork presented Mormonism, 3 years after Cross's masterwork presented Mormonism as a genuine religious phenomenon, a young David Brian Davis concurred, lamenting that most work on Mormonism had treated it as anything but a religion. But departing from Cross's emphasis on Western New York, Davis posited the New England origins of Mormonism. Where Cross saw Mormonism primarily an innovation, a reformist experiment, Davis, perhaps unintentionally echoing Emerson, saw it as a return to the status ante quo of Puritan New England. As an intellectual historian, Davis argued that because Mormonism had been viewed primarily as a social movement, scholars had overlooked its theology in assessing the movement's origin and character. Scrutinizing that theology, Davis found a worldview like that of Joseph Smith's Puritan ancestors, a providential view of history, a dedication to work on God's behalf, a vision of life in which there are no barriers between the spiritual and the temporal, and an identification with and recapitulation of the lives of biblical individuals and peoples, particularly the nation of Israel. Davis posited that these modes of thought were latent in Smith's family heritage, and that he used these cultural survivals to reinvent Puritanism as a revolt against the rising tide of liberalism and individualism. Davis's view of Mormonism as anti-pluralistic has been refined by Mario DePillis in his 1966 The Quest for Religious Authority and the Rise of Mormonism. He argued that, quote, non-Mormon historians have not taken Mormonism seriously as a religion. The purpose of his essay was thus to assess Mormonism's rise from the neglected point of view of historical theology, and thereby show the crucial importance of the doctrine of authority. DePillis dwells less on the specific model Smith had in mind for his movement than on the problem Smith hoped to solve, that of authority. But DePillis does point to Smith's inherited Puritanism as both a pattern that influenced him and one from which he departed. He also identifies the New Testament church, and to a lesser extent, the faith of biblical Israel, as patterns used by Smith. DePillis, like most historians who followed, classes Mormonism as a form of Christian primitivism. Participants in this venerable tradition attempt to restore the primitive church, stripping away the accretions of subsequent centuries and returning to the purity, structure, and power of Christianity as delivered by Christ himself. As an authorized restoration of the original Christian church, Smith was to be the sect to end all sects. But how did Smith claim his authority? Not via the traditional route of apostolic succession, argues DePillis, but via prophetic succession, having the same divine gift as Moses, Isaiah, and Malachi. Smith's prophetic authority on this interpretation empowered him to battle the religious pluralism of his day. Grounding it in this authority, Smith designed his movement to be the antithesis of, an antidote to, the sectarian chaos. DePillis thus shares with Davis the view that early Mormonism reacted against the radical pluralism of the early republic by adopting a model of communal authority and unity from the Christian past. Neither scholar pursues Mormonism's intellectual roots beyond identifying an organizing symbol, that of the primitive church or of Puritan polity. But although the invocation of early Christian and Puritan ideals has been instructive, it fails to account for what's most distinctive in Mormonism. Other primitivists and heirs of the Puritans haven't turned so radical as Mormonism, with its new scripture and blurring of the line between God and humankind. The symbol of restoration can't itself explain this. As Richard T. Hughes has observed, the restoration vision essentially has no content without the intellectual tradition from which it grows, which tells it how to approach and interpret the Bible. Fortunately, Hughes himself has taken up the task of understanding how early Mormonism employed the symbol of primitive Christianity and what philosophical traditions shaped its use. In Two Restoration Traditions, Mormons and Churches of Christ in the 19th century, he examines how Mormonism appropriated the symbol of restoration by comparing and contrasting it with the use of the same symbol in the Churches of Christ movement. Both movements, for Hughes, inherited from the Reformation the desire to return to pure beginnings, but they inherited this impulse through distinct intellectual lineages. Mormonism, through Joseph Smith's Puritan forebears, and the Churches of Christ, through John Knox, a Presbyterian reformer heavily influenced by the Scottish Enlightenment. The result in the latter case was Alexander Campbell's rational progressive primitivism, a, quote, scientific reconstruction of primitive Christianity from the data of the New Testament. While Mormonism also drew from the Enlightenment, its restoration ideal was provided by the Puritans, who sought to recapitulate biblical narrative and defined by Romanticism. Like the Transcendentalists, the Mormons, quote, cared little for the forms and structures of primitive Christianity, but for communion with the divine. For them, the biblical figures were not unique icons, but examples of what any believer might attain to. The Mormons didn't study the Bible, they inhabited it. This also meant that for the Latter-day Saints, the entire Bible, and not only the New Testament, was normative, since the entire Bible contained exemplary patterns of communion with the divine. Thus, Mormonism, unlike the Churches of Christ, sought to restore elements of Old Testament faith along with elements of the New. Hughes's hypothesis that Mormonism was Puritan and Romantic in its appropriation of the Restoration symbol accounts for many of its divergences from traditional Christianity and other Restorationist sects. And it provides direction for further research into how Mormonism patterned itself on Hebrew faith and even, perhaps, sought to recapitulate the sacred narratives of Freemasonry and other esoteric traditions. Preliminary explorations into Mormonism's use of these traditions have been made in the last two decades by Yale's eminent literary critic Harold Bloom, cultural historian John L. Brooke, and Lance Owens. In his 1992 book, The American Religion, Bloom argued that Mormonism is primarily an esoteric restoration. Bloom identified its doctrines of deification and plurality of gods with the tenets of Gnosticism and Kabbalah. Although Bloom remained agnostic on whether Smith was directly influenced by the Kabbalah or reinvented it, Brooke and Owens have conjectured how these underground traditions reached Smith. These arguments by Brooke and Owens have been subjected to substantial criticism, but the question of esoteric influence on Joseph Smith is best approached as one of degree. His well-documented participation in folk magic, primarily by this man right here, and Freemasonry, leaves no doubt that he experienced esoteric and even specifically Kabbalistic influences. With most scholars accepting some admixture of esoteric tradition, such as Freemasonry, and Hebraic content into Mormon Restorationism, the Academy increasingly understands Mormonism to join several streams of thought. But despite the usefulness of such a pluralistic account of Mormon origins in accounting for the variegated data, it runs the risk of lapsing into conceptual chaos, leaving Mormonism an unstructured hodgepodge of influences. Preempting this disintegration, eminent scholar of Mormonism Jan Shipps has synthesized its three restorations into a single model. In her 2000 chapter, Joseph Smith and the Creation of LDS Theology in Sojourner in the Promised Land, Shipps integrates these two restoration ideals. Shipps integrates the Christian primitivist restoration ideal and a Hebraic ideal of the restoration of Israel, along with Mormonism's adoption of esoterica, into a single conceptual framework. Shipps views Mormonism's development as the sequential introduction of three theological strata, layers, or tiers. The metaphor refers, presumably, to geology rather than to a wedding cake, or one dreads to think, to a ward social jello salad. But be that as it may, Shipps's first stratum, the foundation of Mormonism, is identified as Christian primitivism, as taught in the Book of Mormon. Her second stratum, or layer, is the Hebraicizing of Mormonism by Joseph Smith's post-Book of Mormon revelations. In accounting for this second layer, Shipps reasons that as the early saints followed Old Testament patterns in gathering to their promised land and building a temple, these experiences heightened their identification with biblical Israel and thus moved them in a more Hebraic direction. While acknowledging the significant presence of Hebraic elements, like the gathering in the Book of Mormon, Shipps views subsequent Mormon experience as constituting, quote, a pivotal turn of the movement toward the Old Testament experience. The second tier, or Hebraic overlay, as she calls it, changed Mormonism, quote, by adding to it, not by taking things away. To this was added a final dogmatic overlay when, quote, the prophet appended a set of esoteric beliefs derived from Freemasonry and theological speculation to Mormon theology. Shipps' contribution isn't to propose additional sources Joseph Smith used in creating Mormonism, but to order, in terms of chronology and centrality, the sources that have been proposed by others. Her model brings order to what can appear mere chaos, offering some system, method, and comprehensibility to Mormonism's early ideological sprawl. And as Shipps observes, this method of, quote, considering Mormon theology from a historically stratified perspective illuminates what often appears critical and cryptic and enigmatic in Mormonism. It represents an advance on previous works, a more mature stage of thinking, that of synthesis. However, Shipps's work constitutes only a step towards synthesis, not a culmination. For all its virtues, her layered model of Mormon origins fails to explain key features of the Book of Mormon and earliest Mormonism. First, while Shipps is surely correct that the experiences of gathering and building a temple heightened the early Mormons' identification with Israel and thus their use of the Old Testament, this observation begs the deeper question, why were they gathering and building a temple in the first place? These activities themselves require a deeper and earlier explanation. Second, although the Book of Mormon might rightly be described as Christian primitivist, in that it promotes a return to the spiritual, doctrinal, and ritual purity of the church established by Jesus, in this case among the Nephites, its Christian primitivism is atypical and aberrant. Its author or authors had apparently missed the memo that a Christian primitivist should not only purify Christianity from any elements that postdated the New Testament, but also from any that predated it. The Book of Mormon's greatest error, in the eyes of its first analytical reviewer, the great Christian primitivist theologian Alexander Campbell, was that it adulterated the biblical testaments, tearing down the wall of separation that properly divided old from new. To Campbell, the folly of this was self-evident. Of the book's author, he wrote simply, "He represents the Christian institution as practiced among his Israelites before Jesus was born, and as Jews are called Christians while keeping the law of Moses, the Holy Sabbath, and worshiping in their temple, at their altars, and by their high priests." The book's juxtapositions of Hebraic and Christian elements repeatedly jarred Campbell, as when he read the story of King Benjamin. Quote, "King Benjamin assembled the people to sacrifice according to the law around the new temple, and he enjoined upon them at the same time the Christian institutions and gave them a patriarchal valedictory. After they had heard him speak and had offered up their sacrifices, they fell down and prayed in the following words, 'Oh, have mercy and apply the atoning blood of Christ that we may receive forgiveness of our sins.' The Latter-day Church, established by the Book of Mormon, would have also disturbed Campbell. It incorporated deacons and priests, elders and prophets. Third, as Mario DePillis observed, Joseph Smith did not initially or primarily claim the authority on which a Christian primitivist might most sensibly rely, that of apostolic succession. Since the apostles, particularly Peter, had been given authority over the New Testament church, it was their authority that one claimed in order to purify the church, to build it on the rock. But Joseph Smith presented the Book of Mormon and established his faith principally on the authority of prophetic succession. The authority on which he brought about a restoration was not the New Testament authority of an apostle, but the Old Testament authority of a prophet. Prophet come, in this case, not primarily to make prophecy, but to fulfill it. Fourth, the Book of Mormon does not focus mainly on the Christian primitivist objectives appropriate to the first layer of Shipps's model. Hebraic elements, ostensibly belonging to the second, post-Book of Mormon layer, crowd the text like Jews born out of due time. The restoration... My Urim and Thummim is not working properly because this part doesn't make any sense. The restoration the Book of Mormon is chiefly concerned with was not that of the New Testament church, but of Old Testament Israel. Its restoration to unified peoplehood, a promised land, and renewed divine favor under the Abrahamic covenant. The restoration of Israel, though a common enough theme in Joseph Smith's day, was largely rejected by New Testament primitivists. The biblical nation of Israel was not to be restored, it was to be replaced by God's new Israel, the church. Yet the Book of Mormon promotes this restoration throughout. The title page declares the book's aim of showing, quote, the remnant of the house of Israel, what great things the Lord hath done for their fathers, and that they may know the covenants of the Lord. Its fourth verse, from the end of Moroni 10, exhorts God's chosen people to, quote, awake, that the covenants of the eternal Father, which he hath made unto thee, O house of Israel, may be fulfilled. And it returns to such themes scores, if not hundreds of times, between neither the title page nor the concluding chapter use the word church or discuss the church. Also revealing is the Book of Mormon's use of the language of restoration. When the book speaks of restoration, it almost invariably refers to one of four things: the reuniting of body and spirit in the resurrection, the return of human spirits to God, the conversion of Lamanites during its mission narratives, and the restoration of Israel. It several times uses the terms restore and restoration regarding the Jews and Israel, twice employing the precise phrase restoration of the Jews, but it nowhere speaks explicitly of the restoration of the church. Its sole use of restoration in association with the term church is instructive. 2 Nephi 9:2 speaks of the time when the Jews, quote, shall be restored to the true church and fold of God, when they shall be gathered home to the lands of their inheritance and shall be established in all their lands of promise. It is not here that the church needs to be restored, but rather the Jews who need to be restored to the church, God's fold. The only restoration to which the church is relevant in this passage is that of Israel. The Book of Mormon also prophesied the building of a sacred city in the American Promised Land, pulling the New Jerusalem down from the celestial realm where Christians had traditionally placed it and setting it on terrestrial foundations. This city was to house, quote, the sanctuary of the Lord, a temple. Believers in the new scripture promptly recognized the need for a new temple as central and urgent. Months before the book's publication, before the public had encountered its contents, the second known news article on Mormonism, which is no longer extant, from the Palmyra Freeman, reported that the book's believers planned the immediate construction of a temple. The seriousness with which believers in the Book of Mormon regarded this prophecy is indicated. That's a repetition. The Judaic elements of Book of Mormon faith were not secondary or additive. The Hebraic was not a gilding on the new faith, it was integral. From at least the time the extant Book of Mormon was translated or dictated, Mormonism, unlike the other Christian primitivisms, has been a religion of lineage, law, covenant, temple, peoplehood, priesthood, and prophets. Thus, in this early layer, it was already fully a synthesis of Christian and Judaic, as the Book of Mormon plates were described as by Joseph Smith's brother William as comprised of two metals, gold and copper. So the Book of Mormon text was an alloy of two restorationisms, Christian and Judaic, ecclesiastical and ethnic. As a revision, then, to Shipps's model, we might posit a primary Mormon stratum comprised of these two elements, but I would propose an even more radical revision. Rather than having Shipps's first and second layers appear simultaneously and pre-mixed, I would reverse the order of these layers. The blended or alloyed faith of Mormons in 1829 and the early 1830s was itself the result of the laying down of two successive theological strata, Judaic primitivism and Christian primitivism, in that order. Evidence for this may be found in Mormonism's earliest revelatory texts and in the testimony of those who observed its founding. Two accounts describing the early translation period, late 1827 and early 1828, when Joseph Smith worked on the Book of Lehi, the now lost 116 pages, portray Smith and his associates holding an unfamiliar understanding of what the book and the work in which they were engaged was about. The first account comes from John H. Gilbert, Gilbert was a Palmyra resident and friend of Martin Harris, who became the typesetter for the 1830 Book of Mormon. Having been closely involved in the coming forth of the Book of Mormon, Gilbert left a number of testimonies regarding the book's origins, particularly its printing. These latter accounts can be and have been tested for accuracy against the extant original manuscript of the Book of Mormon and printer's manuscript, which he described in some detail. Such comparisons show Gilbert to have possessed a remarkably acute memory, even into old age. Thus, Gilbert's 1879 testimony of how he first learned of the Book of Mormon merits serious consideration. He wrote, "Late in 1827 or early in 28 was the first I heard Harris speak of Joe's finding the plates, and with the plates a large pair of spectacles, by looking through which Joe could translate the hieroglyphics on the plates into English. The plates found by Joe, as represented at the time, purported to be a history of the lost tribes of Israel, and not establishing a new religion, but confirming the Old Testament. The description of the Book of Mormon as a story of, quote, lost tribes of Israel was common, even among non-Mormons acquainted with the book's contents. Far less familiar is Martin Harris's reported description of the book, not as the foundation for a new church or sect, but as a second witness to the Old Testament. Writing of this same period in an affidavit published in the Susquehanna Register in May 1834, only 6 years after the fact, a Harmony area neighbor of Joseph and Emma Smith, Hezekiah McCune, reported that in conversation, Joseph had characterized himself as, quote, a prophet sent by God to bring in the Jews and the greatest prophet that had ever arisen. These reports dovetail in describing the 1827-1828 period of work on the Book of Mormon as one in which those involved in the project characterized the work in distinctly Hebraic terms, not the founding of a Christian church, but the gathering of the Jews through a book that confirmed the Old Testament. These reports indicate that the understanding of the book's nature and purpose shifted between early 1828 and 1829, when testimony shows that the book was understood as explicitly Christian in character, and also the content in the manuscripts shows that. Significantly, such a shift in perceptions appears to mirror the unfolding of the book's content over the same period. One example of this may be found in the story of King Benjamin at the beginning of the Book of Mosiah. Evidence indicates that this was the first part of the book to be dictated after the 1828 loss of the 116-page Book of Lehi manuscript. Joseph Smith's sister Catherine testified that the angel commanded him to respond to the loss by resuming the translation where he had left off, rather than immediately dictate the replacement for the lost portion. And the extant Book of Mormon manuscripts show that our current Book of Mosiah, or our current Mosiah chapter 1, was originally numbered chapter 3, indicating that the actually on the manuscript they've got there's a Roman numeral 3, and then two of the lines are crossed out to make it a 1, indicating that the first two chapters, apparently indicating that the first two chapters that had been dictated had been lost, or in other words, that they would have been part of the 116 lost pages. Thus, the current opening of the Book of Mormon is the scene between the extant text and the lost text. This portion of the book opens with a magisterial sermon by King Benjamin, in which he announces the coming of the Messiah, that, quote, the Lord God Omnipotent, who shall be called Jesus Christ, the Son of God, would come. And how did King Benjamin know this? As he declared to his people, quote, the things which I shall tell you are made known unto me by an angel from God. That the Messiah's name needed to be declared or revealed to Benjamin by an angel would imply that he had not previously known it. And if such explicit Christian content had not been familiar to Benjamin up to this time, it almost certainly would not have been presented to the reader in the text of the Book of Lehi. So what I'm suggesting here is that there's a confluence between these the testimonies of Hezekiah McCune and John H. Gilbert and what we can infer of the content of the Book of Lehi, the last 116 pages, specifically that it probably was not explicitly Christian. It would have spoken of the Messiah, but perhaps not used the name Jesus Christ or otherwise said something that would have marked it as not Judaic, but Christian. And D&C 10, later talking about the loss of the Book of Lehi manuscript and the need to replace it, describes, it says that the lost portion, it says that the replacement text, the small plates, contained things that were more express in what God wanted to tell the people. They had more specific and detailed content. So it was actually providential then that the Book of Lehi had been lost, which would dovetail, which would fit nicely with this explanation that I'm offering. If these ideas are right, or even make a strong hypothesis, then scholars wishing to place Mormonism in its proper historical context should look not only at Christian primitivist sects of Joseph Smith's time and the debates going on within Christian primitivism, but also at discussions on the restoration of Israel during his day, the debates over that, and at the proto-Zionist projects that sought to begin this restoration of Israel, such as Mordecai Noah's attempt to gather the Jews to an island in the state of New York in the years just preceding the coming forth of the Book of Mormon. So on this model, the Judaic Christianity that we see in the present Book of Mormon might be explained as an evolution in which originally we have a Judaic faith or Judaic movement or project, one that has the goal of gathering the Jews. And then on top of this, coming from the later dictation or translation of the Book of Mormon, we would have this explicit Christian content, and the two would be melded. And so that would be the origin of this very distinctive Hebraic Christianity. So if this is correct, then the Hebraic flowering that Jan Shipps describes as her second layer of Mormonism would be the logical outworking of what had already and always been there. Thank you. Yes?
Actually, then, we might conceive of the layer that Jan Shipps talks about as a third layer, seems to me, because the content of the first layer that you've described and the later layer from the mid-1830s on, the content is quite different, it seems to me, in the two. Mm-hmm. After the influence of the Hebrew teacher who came to Kirtland, and after the establishment of the notion of a temple, even though the Kirtland Temple was a fairly primitive form of what came later, and the patriarchal blessing, the idea of literal Israelite descent for the Smith family and others, which comes early in the 1830s, seems to me the content is different between the layer you're talking about and what Jan Shipps is talking about. Mm-hmm. And so you might well be right that that what I'm now suggesting is the third layer was an outgrowth ultimately of the first one. But it seems to me they are distinct, and I think your discovery of that first layer is quite interesting, and it certainly fits in with what we know about the preoccupations of the time, not just for the Latter-day Saints, but the whole American religious establishment was, as you know better than most, I think, was preoccupied with millennialism and messianism and the restoration of Jews. So anyway, thanks for that. I think appreciate your pointing out that earlier Hebrew layer that comes really before the church is organized.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Just to comment on that. I hadn't thought of actually conceiving of that later Judaic flowering as another layer, but it would make sense. You'd have a one sort of Judaic layer, then a Christian primitivist layer, then another Judaic layer. So you'd have a sandwich, or to get the farms guys excited, like a chiasmus. You know, go right back to where it started.
The couple of influences that you didn't point out, maybe this is not part of your paper, would have been just Joseph Smith's own family preoccupation with their religious views, looking at his grandfather and father and his mother primarily. And then there was another significant influence, at least I think, that is not discussed much, and that was Alvin's time at Hanover College, where he, for the teachings of the head there, I've forgotten the names now, seemed to be, had some remarkable parallels to later Joseph Smith thought. Alvin coming back and spending an entire year with Joseph during his recovery from his operation, and some of that carryover influence. Now, how would some of that earlier influence fit in with your thesis here?
I believe the influence you're talking about would be, it would certainly be, if I'm thinking of the same things you are, different sorts of Christian influence. So insofar as it factored into the development of Mormonism, I would think it would be in that second layer. I'm not necessarily trying to integrate all the different individual influences, but yeah, maybe who knows, eventually we might end up with really complex models that nonetheless are able to really synthesize the data well. When I talk about this first layer being Judaic, also I'm not saying then that Joseph Smith and his family were not Christian primitivists. They certainly had that impulse. But rather I'm saying that the project at that time doesn't seem to me to have been understood in explicitly Christian primitivist terms. Thank you.
Sure. Is this working toward your thesis?
Yes.
Okay. The interesting thing about this to me, it's always fun to see someone with a shotgun taking a wide shot across a lot of fields. I think you should be encouraged in that. It always is, you have to be extra brave to undergo the scrutiny there. But just some things you might want to think about in this. One of your approaches is a textual approach, yeah, which traditionally belongs to the theological studies side of the academic thing. So you might be thinking about that. The more interesting to me side of your approach would be the perception analysis, looking at what the people thought they were doing, mm-hmm, what they were engaged in, and going back through their manuscripts, through their letters, the quippings, their writings. You know, it really doesn't matter as much. Now I'm speaking from my historical bias here, and that was my history teacher right over there. From the historical perspective, it really doesn't matter as much what the Book of Mormon says or what the 116 pages had, as much as it does what people thought, what they thought it said, and what they thought it had. Mm-hmm. So I would really encourage you to sort of focus your efforts on the historical side, to go into those writings and build your model out of their writings. And to not worry so much about what the Book of Mormon says, but rather look at what they thought it said. And do you see the difference?
Yeah, yeah.
And go at it from that historical perspective and build your model from that. That would be my encouragement to you.
Okay, yes. Yes, Mike.
In terms of model building, the Book of Lehi itself is a kind of anachronism in the sense that Lehi was born in post-exilic Israel, in the post-Egyptian exile.
Yeah.
It was pre-exilic in terms of the Babylonian exile, but it's a priest-defined culture that he's born into and that his family is raised in. However, his perspective from the point we learn about it in the Book of Nephi, which is a doctrinally emphasized recapitulation of Lehi's book, is patriarchal. And so in some senses, my guess is that the Book of Lehi was an anachronism in the sense that it did not emphasize priestly powers, it did not emphasize the tribes of Israel, it emphasized the experience of a patriarch, someone like Abraham and his family, and so that the narrative of the Book of Abraham, or pardon me, the Book of Lehi, would have been in many ways like early Genesis, pre-Moses, mm-hmm. pre-Levitical, mm-hmm. An emphasis on the kind of relationships with God that we connect with the patriarchs. And that changed in the emphasis that you have in Nephi and the smaller books and Mosiah, where it's very much doctrinal, but it's also very much priestly. And I think that if we can look at what might have been the emphasis of the Book of Lehi, mm-hmm. it would have been Abrahamic. It would have been as if there were no, even though he was born in a post-Egyptian experience and a Levitical kind of experience as a historical character, that Lehi's own narrative would have been very patriarchal.
I think that makes sense to me, and one reason why is it seems like there's an implicit comparison at least in the Book of Nephi, first Book of Nephi, between Nephi and Joseph of Egypt and Lehi and Jacob, and so the sort of model figure for how Lehi is presented is one of the Old Testament patriarchs.
I'm kind of curious about why the church decided to name itself the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, when there is so much Judaic tradition in there. And I guess it's kind of the ongoing issue of why mainstream Protestant and Catholic churches don't really consider Mormons Christian. And I just wondered if you had any comments on that. I mean, was that just a later stage that Christianity rose to the top and became the main emphasis?
I think
about the church or the restoration of the Jews.
Right. I think, although I do think that there's a Judaic layer that precedes the Christian primitivist layer that Jan Shipps is talking about, I do think she's right that there is a Christian primitivist layer there with, like in 1829, 1830, particularly right around the time the church is organized. And so the name, the name they originally gave is just Church of Christ, which there were other primitivist denominations who chose that same name. It seemed if you were trying to get back to the New Testament Church of Christ, it seemed the natural thing. Don't name yourself after some guy like Luther or something. Name it after Jesus. And so I think probably the fact that the church was organized in this Christian primitivist phase influenced a lot of the name and the structure and a lot of things, basic things about it. Yes, Armin.
Probably we shouldn't forget that for at least the first 100 years of the original Christian church, you would see a strong Hebrew context. So I don't find it any more anomalous that the LDS church would be named the Church of Jesus Christ, considering its primitive precursors, than that the original Christian church would have thought of itself as a new Church of Jesus Christ, even though it comes strongly out of a Hebrew background and continue to convey Hebrew notions. We tend to forget that the Orthodox Christianity that we now know is a product of the 4th century, not the 1st century.
And I think, you know, with this having a Judaic layer, as I'm arguing, and then adding this Christian primitivism to it and coming up with a more Judaic Christianity, arguably then that gets you back closer to first century Christianity, which was more Judaic in character.
Have you had a chance to sort of look at the debate over supersessionism?
You mean over whether Christianity superseded Judaism?
Well, I think most people probably assume that it has. It's just a good idea to be aware of both sides of the Judaic side of that debate as well. And I think it would probably inform what you're talking about here, particularly in an academic audience.
Okay.
Well, if I could speak to that again, it seems to me from my reading of the period, Joseph Oliver and his associates, that they very much had that debate going on. And here I'm informed in large part by the book on Mormons and Jews by Epperson. It seems from that, and even from the critical commentary on Epperson that came out later, that where Joseph Smith finally came down on this was to decide that the Jews had a side deal with God. That it wasn't up to the Latter-day Saints to convert the Jews. And as you know, as a historical matter, there never has been a sustained effort to convert Jews. We had 3 brief and abortive efforts in the 20th century to convert Jews, but it has never, that's a real anomaly, because Mormons figure almost, you know, everybody else in the world should be converted. But we seem to be leaving it up to the Lord God to decide when, whether, and how to bring the Jews into that fold.
So, someone needs to send that revelation back to Salt Lake. Yeah. If you go to some Judaic websites and look at what persons in Judaism have to say about the church, you'll see it's not very complimentary.
Oh, yeah, quite understandable. It's not.
And in large part, it has to do with what we call the work for the dead.
Right.
And the Holocaust survivor, or the Holocaust
right.
victims.
No, I think that's the main source of the
Holocaust. But anyway, I think when you start talking and throwing around talking about Judaic origins and things like that, in a Mormon audience, you're fine. But when you start talking and trying to publish for the outside world, I think it would be good to at least to be aware and have some good background there on supersessionism.
Okay. Thank you.
You bet. Anything else? We can go to the next page. How long have you been working on your paper?